Today with me, Audrey Carvel, on the BBC World Service. It's the final day of our guest editor series, the opportunity for one well-known person to choose some of the programme's agenda. They have the idea and we produce the content. Well, if you're tuning in for the first time this week, shame on you. You have missed the Italian author Randa Gazi, the British Olympic double gold champion Kelly Holmes, and the Polish film director Agnieszka Holland. Well, today we have someone from the world of politics editing the programme. In fact, he's president of a country. Stay tuned to find out who he is in a few minutes' time. But first, to a story which has shocked and outraged Britain. An 11-year-old boy was gunned down as he made his way home from a game of football with friends last night. Two teenagers have been arrested. Rhys Jones was walking near his house in the northwest city of Liverpool when he was shot in the neck. His mother raced to the scene and cradled her son as he lay dying. His murder has stunned the country. The Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, called it a heinous crime. It comes amid an apparent rise in stabbings and gun deaths of teenage boys in cities across England. Well, two of Rhys's neighbours gave their reactions.
I'm just so surprised it was Rhys, because he's a nice kid. You know, I'd say hello to him in the street and stuff. I'm just so surprised it was round here. In our street. Just shocking, really.
I didn't know Rhys well and knew him to say hello to in the street and stuff. He was a nice, polite kid. I do feel for his parents today. It's awful what happened. I'm just surprised that it's round here and it was so close to home.
You'd never believe that an 11-year-old kid, innocent kid, is having a game of football now. He'll probably going off at his tea. And then some scallywag just goes past and shoots at random or at somebody else, and then accidentally or purposely shot at an 11-year-old boy in the head. I just can't believe it. Just can't believe it.
Well, our correspondent Rob Broomby is in Liverpool this evening. He joins me now. Rob, what's the mood there at the moment?
Very, very despondent indeed, very downhearted. People are shocked that something like this can come to an area like this. People have heard many things about Liverpool over the years. It is a city with a very hard edge and many crime and deprivation problems. But this community was one that felt itself relatively safe. It was a new development. It was one of the bigger private developments in the 1980s. People thought this was quite calm. But now this has come to the surface, people are acknowledging that there has been a growing problem with antisocial behaviour and gang-related violence. So very despondent.
Is there any suggestion that this young boy was involved in any of these gangs?
None at all that he himself was involved. The police are adamant that he was innocent, that he came from a reliable and responsible family. It does seem to have been a case of mistaken identity, the wrong place at the wrong time, if you like. But what is also clear when you talk to young people in this area is that they feel the perpetrators may well have been involved in a gang, maybe looking for somebody else. And there is a lot of tension here between people on this estate, young people on this estate, and the neighbouring area of Norris Green, an area with a far worse reputation. These things seem to have kicked off over very little indeed, but as I say, the evidence we're getting at the moment on the ground is that he was simply an innocent boy in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Rob, many thanks indeed. So is this rise in gun crime among young people unique to Britain, or is it happening elsewhere in Europe too? Roger Grafe is a criminologist. He has also made a number of documentaries about juvenile crime, and he joins me now. Mr. Grafe, thank you for joining us. Is it happening everywhere in Europe?
Well, in a way, the problem is that a lot of the violence that happens between teenagers is not reported to the police, and the degree to which it surfaces on specific occasions doesn't reflect a kind of statistical norm, if you see what I mean. You get there's been quite a lot of stabbings and quite a lot of shootings, alas, that haven't attracted the attention this has, because the boy was 11, he was white, a nice kid in a good community, and that suddenly, you know, breaks out of the stereotype of the other kinds of violence, which really barely attract our attention until people start setting fire to other people's cars or doing, which happened in Paris, as you know, and that kind of violence, which also has happened in parts of Germany and even in parts of Italy. But until it goes above the parapet, as it were, that happens quietly a great deal of the time.
And youth gun crime, where one teenager opens fire with a gun on another, is that prevalent in France or Germany or Italy?
Well, I mean, it depends on the style. It's not prevalent as in, quite as common, if you like, as it was in American inner cities, where you have very much more visible organized gangs. But if those people who are listening ever saw La Haine, you're looking at the kind of violence there that certainly echoes the same disaffection and the same sense of feeling that they will attack others randomly.
Is it to do with the fact that is a lot of this crime concentrated in areas where these teenagers simply have nothing else to do?
Well, you know, when Audrey, it's very interesting you say that, because I feel slightly sheepish almost saying that kind of remark when people are talking about life and death issues. It sounds like, you know, everyone looks back on their own teenage and say, well, we all hung around on street corners, we didn't end up shooting people, what's wrong with these kids? But that stands for something. The number of youth clubs, again, listeners may not believe what I'm about to tell them, but in Britain, the majority of youth clubs are shut on weekends, evenings, and school holidays. Not evenings necessarily in the weekday, but on the weekends and school holidays. They're shut because they're paid for out of the education department. Now, that whoever the brilliant civil servant was that came up with that notion simply wasn't thinking how important it actually is to keep kids at just the point when they want to prove themselves, test themselves, get into gangs in order to protect themselves and so on, give them a safe place. And it's very interesting, in Boston, I made a film there where the after-school clubs for 11 to 14-year-olds produced a serious drop in gang violence, shooting, and teenage pregnancies. Right? And this is for middle school. We're not just talking about higher teenagers. At just the point when coming home from school, they felt incredibly vulnerable. This was in daylight, for example, this shooting. And the notion that it only happens at night, it only happens between, you know, big, tough, largely black kids, if you like, that's simply not true. The process of proving yourself, becoming an adult, becoming a man, and so on, becomes, you know, traditionally it's always been a kind of violent task. Think of the Capulets and the Montagues. But now, with guns being more available and knives being more available and celebrated, in, I have to say, in the media as well, then kids who are trying to find an identity for themselves, whatever language they speak, whatever country they're in, will turn to these weapons because they're scared.
Okay. Roger, we must leave it there, but thank you very much indeed for that. Criminologist Roger Grayful, what do you think is behind this gun crime? Let us know your thoughts. Our email address is europe@bbc.co.uk. You're listening to Europe Today. And now it's time to meet today's guest editor, the person who has decided some of our programme's agenda today. He was born in Stockholm to parents who had fled from Estonia. He grew up in the United States and graduated with degrees in psychology from the Universities of Columbia and Pennsylvania. During the 1980s, he worked as a journalist for Radio Free Europe, when he also became actively involved in politics. He's been a foreign minister twice, leader of a political party, an MEP, and finally a president. Tomas Hendrik Ilves, president of Estonia, you're very welcome to Europe Today.
Thank you very much, and good evening.
Now, The Economist magazine in January of this year described you as a star in the making, suave, savvy and cynical. Does that sum you up?
Well, perhaps that's how I'm perceived, but I don't think I'm cynical and certainly not very suave.
Did you ever expect to become president of your country?
Not even during the elections.
Why was that?
Well, I just didn't think it would happen. But it has, and stranger things have happened in life. So that's what I do today.
And your mission to put your country on the map, are you achieving that?
Well, I think Estonia actually is on the map, and it's not always due to what Estonians do. But certainly I see a very strong part of my mission to bring Estonia to where it would have been, no matter what, had it not gone through the tortuous history of 1940-1991, to return to European normalcy, a firm, strong member of the European Union and of NATO.
Well, your first choice today is to do with cybercrime, and that's an issue very pertinent to Estonia, one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world. Our listeners may remember back in May when websites of your government ministries, political parties, newspapers, banks and companies were all sent into meltdown thanks to cyber warfare. Here's a little reminder.
A couple of weeks ago when the whole thing started, we had some problems in our online services, and then our mail server was absolutely inundated with spam emails as well. So that happened in just about a few minutes' time. About 600 emails came in. Usually things are pretty calm here.
That was one journalist describing the impact in her office. Mr. President, is everything back to normal now?
Oh, yes, things are quite okay. I think, in fact, we've learned quite a bit from the cyber attacks. In many ways, Estonia was much better prepared than some other countries, simply because as a very cutting-edge country when it comes to information technology, we had done a good deal of preparation for possible attacks for the elections that we had in February of this, or in March, sorry, of the beginning of March of this year, in which people could vote via the internet.
At the time, the Prime Minister of Estonia was very categoric in blaming Russia. Is that still very much the view in Estonia, that it was Russia was to blame?
Well, the nature of the attacks makes it virtually impossible to directly link anything to anyone. But the circumstantial evidence is so preponderant that, we're quite sure it's not Uruguay. If you read the current account of the cyber attacks in the IT magazine Wired, there it's quite clear that there was a very strong involvement from the Russian side. It's very difficult to say who was actually behind it, but certainly there were massive attacks done with things called botnets, or networks of robot computers or zombie computers that inundate computers. And this is something which is, and perhaps even the most sinister side of this, is that it is actually an aspect of organized crime, that was highly organized from above. Who did it?
Let's talk about how this cyber warfare actually happens. And joining me now is Bill Thompson, an expert on these issues. Mr. Thompson, how does it work?
Well, there are a variety of different methods that can be used. What happened to Estonia in May, one thing that happened was just simple hacking into websites. Some websites were defaced. But most of the problems that the country encountered were to do with this thing called distributed denial of service attacks, which is the jargon term for when large numbers of computers scattered all over the internet send requests to a web server at around the same time, and the server simply can't cope. Or they send thousands of emails at the same time, and the computers at the receiving end simply can't cope. And this can be done in a number of ways. One is just to have lots of people literally sort of typing in, trying to access a website. But obviously, you need large numbers of individuals involved. And the most common method is the one that the president referred to there, what are called botnets, where computers which have been infected with computer viruses are actually taken over, turned to the service of the hackers here, and used to send large numbers of requests to the target machines.
And is it ever possible to prove who's responsible?
It's incredibly difficult. It would, in principle, you might find out who controlled one of the botnets that was being used to attack a particular Estonian target, and then you could possibly find out who paid them for this service, because organized crime is involved with this to the extent that if you've got a few thousand dollars to spare, you can actually buy the services of a botnet, of these tens of thousands of computers around the internet, to attack your enemies. So there may be a paper trail, but it's going to be very, very difficult to actually sort of pin it on any one individual or group or country.
Okay, Bill, stay with us. We can hear now from someone else who has first-hand experience of cyber crime. Paddy Power runs a betting company which operates on the high street and online. And a few years ago, his firm was targeted by cyber criminals. From Dublin, he told me what happened.
the best analogy to use is that there was like hundreds of people trying to get through the door of the betting shop at the one time, and no one could get through because it just, like, what the distributed denial of service attack does is slows everything down, really. And it was, I suppose it's pretty frustrating, really, because you know something's wrong immediately, and then you kind of have to follow the route of kind of letting the authorities know, the National High Tech Crime Unit, which I think might actually be run by the MI5 now, and then your service provider, and they go off to their service provider, and all the big service providers try and pinpoint these criminals wherever they are in the world, and try and shut them down, I suppose, or put up firewalls to stop them. So it's really just a big pain in the neck more than anything else, you know.
Did they get in touch in any way to look for money to persuade them to stop what they were doing?
At that stage, I don't think so. We passed everything over as soon as we saw what was happening. We passed everything directly over to the National High Tech Crimes Unit. So, and I think it was whatever way they got to the bottom of whatever way they got to the bottom of it quite quickly, really. So sometimes it sounds like something out of the movies, doesn't it, when you're held to ransom and give us like $1 million or whatever. But it wasn't quite as dramatic as that. So I think it was kind of nipped in the bud, really, more than anything else, I think.
What do you know about the people who did it?
Well, nothing, really. Not even sure where they are. Because I suppose the scariest thing about these is that me, you, anyone else could actually be taking part in it without realising. Because if we happen to download a virus unwittingly or whatever, somebody else could control our PCs and send emails, like send whatever, thousands of emails to Paddy Power. And all we know is that maybe our internet is working slightly slower than it normally does. So I suppose it's quite a difficult job. I'm not the most technical person in the world. I don't exactly know how the service providers might do, but some of the big ones like the cable and wireless and stuff like that, the huge service providers will go and try and pinpoint where the connection originates from.
Have you been able to do anything to prevent this happening again?
Well, you just honestly, all you can do is work with the experts and the service providers, and try and put up like as good firewalls as you can. Be aware of it more than anything else, because the first time it happens, you're kind of scratch your head going, "Hang on a sec, what's going on?" And I think you just have to be aware of it, and react as quickly as soon as you see something happening. Just get straight onto the authorities and onto the service providers, and fingers crossed they sort it out.
That was Paddy Power. Let's talk again to Bill Thompson, an expert on all of this. Bill, listening there to Mr. Power, an online gambling company as well, is it like a protection racket that these cyber criminals run?
In some cases it can be. I think sometimes it's just people showing off. Essentially, they do it because they can do it. They're showing off their technological prowess. Other times there have definitely been sort of instances where money has been demanded with menaces. And of course, with Estonia earlier this year, it was much more a politically motivated attack. So there are lots of different reasons why this might happen. The method of attack is the same in all cases, but what the people are trying to get out of it might be very different.
What's the worst case scenario? I mean, we've heard about the governments under attack in Estonia. Presumably, governments around the world are at risk.
Oh, indeed. And the worst case scenario is that critical services are taken offline, they become inaccessible. That as we become more dependent on these online services, if you can't get to your bank, that can be worrying. If you can't pay your income tax, that can be a problem. But if you can't get, say, to an online health service, where that's the only way you can get health advice, that could be life-threatening. So as we become more reliant on internet infrastructure, attacks on it do become more threatening. And it becomes sort of important for governments, for agencies, for the military even, to be involved in this to ensure that protections are put in place.
Is it possible, for example, that intelligence agencies could be accessed and have very important, sensitive, classified information stolen?
It's possible but unlikely, because by and large that sensitive information is not available over the public internet. And here we're talking about attacks on public web servers, on sites and services that have to be visible to anyone in order to be useful. The more critical secure information tends to be quite well hardened.
What can be done to prevent this sort of thing?
Well, it's about sort of thinking about how the network works. So in the Estonian case, one of the things they did was just to cut off access from outside the country for a period of time. And that obviously stopped the attacks, but also limited the usefulness of the internet services. The other things you can do is essentially to have teams of very bright engineers. Estonia has its computer emergency response team, who did a brilliant job back in May, who essentially juggle the network resources around, try to monitor what's going on, block what traffic they can, and almost dynamically handle handle the problem, as if they're weathering a storm. And they can usually do very good things. And then the final thing to do is to distribute the resources. One of the things that we're seeing is if you attack an individual web server, you might be able to bring it down. If its contents and its services are replicated across a number of different sites over the internet, then it's much harder to attack all of them. So you can make the whole network more robust in that way.
So it's a technical rather than a legislative approach that's needed.
Yes, I mean, there's already a lot of legislation in place which would cope with this, which would make this illegal either because it's blackmail or because it's sort of abuse of computer systems. There's been a proposal in the UK House of Lords to make running a botnet actually a criminal offence in itself, never mind how it's used, and that might help in terms of later prosecution. But by and large, it's going to be technical solutions that make this a less effective thing to do, and so people just don't bother doing it anymore.
OK, very good to talk to you this evening. Thank you very much indeed, Bill Thompson there, an expert on everything to do with tackling cyber crime. You're listening to Europe Today. Now let's catch up with all the very latest sports news on the programme. Kirsten Webster is with us this evening. And Kirsten, the World Athletics governing body has been forced to concede that it might not be able to push through its tougher stance on drugs use.
Yes, that's right, Audrey. On Wednesday, delegates at a conference of the IAAF in Japan had voted to double the punishment for serious first-time drug offences from 2 to 4 years, but they've now conceded it may not be implemented. And the reason being, the IAAF is signed up to the World Anti-Doping Agency Code, and so they will need the permission of WADA, and in turn WADA needs to get the backing of all the signatories to the code, which means all the Olympic sports need to sign up to this. So there's still a lot of negotiation to be done on this, and the former Olympic pole vault champion and newly elected vice president of the IAAF, Sergei Bubka, is determined to try.
We know that it's not an easy case, and we know that many federation is not in favor to increase to 4 years banned. But we need to work, we need to explain, and we cannot accept what's going on, as we can see in some sports, and some cheaters exist.
That was Sergei Bubka there, and the World Athletics Championship start on Saturday in Japan. Moving now to football, Kirsten. Real Madrid, they've been showing off their new two prize signings today.
Yes, Gabriel Ainsley and Ian Robben have both moved from the English Premier League in the last 24 hours. Ainsley leaves Manchester United, of course, for a fee of about $16 million, while Robben is believed to be costing about $42 million from Chelsea. And the Chelsea chairman, Bruce Buck, told the BBC they're sad to see the Dutch winger go, but the fee was just too good to turn down.
We've done some very good business there for Chelsea Football Club. I mean, the downside of that is that he's a very good player and we would have liked him to stay. But for whatever reason, and you'll have to ask him, he did not want to stay here. And once that decision was made, I think we decided that, okay, but if we are going to sell him, it's got to be at the right price. And I think it has been.
And just finally, Kirsten, British tennis player Tim Henman bowing out.
Yes, finally. Possibly one of the worst-kept secrets of late, Tim Henman has confirmed at a press conference in New York just an hour ago that he will quit the sport after 13 years in tennis. Henman says family commitments and injuries have forced his decision. And fittingly, he'll play his last match on the Wimbledon courts next month in Britain's Davis Cup tie against Croatia. That's the scene of his greatest successes and, of course, where he has his own hill, Henman Hill, of course.
Kirsten, many thanks indeed, Kirsten Webster, rounding up the day's sports news. You're listening to Europe Today on the BBC World Service. Stay tuned. We'll have the rest of the choices of our guest editor today, the President of Estonia.
At bbcnews.com, you can stay in touch with the latest global news online. With updates every minute of every day, you can read the latest reports and developments from around the world. The big stories are covered in detail with background information, interactive maps and timelines of the key issues. And with the BBC's news player, you can watch and hear the most recent news bulletins with a selection of audio and video clips covering a range of stories. And if you've got something to say about world events, you can air your views at bbcnews.com and click on Have Your Say. With more correspondents in more places than any other broadcaster, the BBC's network of reporters are ideally placed to provide the news and analysis when the big stories happen. Read their reports online at bbcnews.com and stay tuned for the latest news developments here on the BBC World Service.
You're listening to Europe Today with me, Audrey Carvel, and still to come this Thursday, a Danish shipping company pays a ransom to free its five-man crew from Somali pirates. Also, the remaining choice of our guest editor, the president of Estonia. We'll be examining how a 68-year-old pact still influences people in the Baltics today. And will Estonia ever make peace with its giant neighbour, Russia? All that and a little bit more still to come, but first a summary of the latest news.
BBC World News with Jonathan Wheatley. The Supreme Court in Pakistan has ruled that the deposed former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif can return home from exile. Mr. Sharif was replaced by General Pervez Musharraf in a military coup in 1999. After the court's ruling, Mr. Sharif said he would return home as soon as possible. He said it was the beginning of the end for General Musharraf. The military-backed government in Bangladesh has reimposed a curfew in the capital Dhaka and five other cities to try to quell 3 days of rioting in which a man was killed. The curfew was lifted temporarily earlier in the day but was quickly reinforced with police hurrying traffic and people off the streets. The authorities in Brazil say at least 20 convicts have been killed in a fire at a prison in Ponte Nova after a fight between rival gangs of inmates. Reports indicate that a group of prisoners started the fire to settle a score with a rival gang. A Malaysian newspaper has apologised for publishing a front-page image purporting to show Jesus Christ holding a cigarette. The Tamil-language newspaper said staff had taken the picture from the internet to illustrate a quotation from the Bible, but nobody noticed that it had been tampered with. Police in Iraq say suspected Al-Qaeda gunmen have killed a number of civilians in Diyala province, including a local Sunni Arab religious figure who encouraged the community to confront the militants. Several people were abducted and a number of others reportedly killed in clashes. The authorities in the South African city of Cape Town have appealed for the army to be deployed on the country's most famous landmark, Table Mountain, because of a rise in crime there. The head of tourism in Cape Town said police resources were being overwhelmed. And a Vietnamese man has been reunited with his family 40 years after he was separated from his mother during the Vietnam War. The man was a baby when his mother dropped him during an American bombing raid. His parents had long since given him up for dead. BBC World News.
You're listening to Europe Today with me, Audrey Carvel, and a special edition of the programme today. Our guest editor is the president of Estonia, Tuomas Hendrik Ilves. He has chosen some of the items you've been hearing. In the first half, we talked about cybercrime and how to tackle it, and the rest of his choices to come a little bit later. But first, the owner of a Danish cargo ship, which was hijacked by Somali pirates, paid a ransom to have the vessel and its five-man crew released after more than 80 days in captivity. That's according to the Danish government, which also said it was disappointed that a ransom had been paid. The Danica White had been on its way from Dubai to the Kenyan port of Mombasa when it was seized by the pirates on June the 1st. They had demanded $1.5 million. It's not clear how much was actually paid. The Danish Sailors Trades Union said it had been willing to pay the ransom quickly, but was prevented from doing so by the Danish Foreign Ministry. The Secretary of the Union, Morten Bach, said the crew should not have been held hostage for so long.
To sit down there not knowing what their destiny will be, with a Kalashnikov to their head, not knowing if they'll ever return home. It's so scary, and the Foreign Ministry has known that fact all along. That's why I'm relieved the sailors are coming home alive, because we feared that one of them would get shot, that the kidnappers would put action behind their words. That could easily have happened.
Well, Hans Tino Hansen is the managing director of the Danish security company Protocol. It advises shipping firms about piracy and negotiations, and he joins me this evening from Copenhagen. Mr. Hansen, you weren't involved in this particular case. Should a ransom have been paid?
In theory, ransom should never be paid, but in practice, especially in the area in Somalia, you simply have to pay ransom.
How do you decide?
The thing is that Somalia is a special case. It's a country without a central power that controls the country and or the coastline. This means that the pirates have reasonably free zones along the coast to operate. Therefore, it is impossible for third parties to intervene with the pirates and the hijackings. All cases in Somalia hijackings where negotiations have taken place have ended with a ransom paid.
If a ransom hadn't have been paid, would these sailors have been in danger? Could they have been killed by the pirates?
Ultimately, yes. Of course, that's the ultimate threat of the pirates, to kill the crew. Luckily, in Somalia, there haven't been any killings for many years of hijacked crews. There is one unconfirmed incident from this year, but again, that was unconfirmed. Otherwise, they have been treated relatively okay.
Are Somali waters the most dangerous for piracy?
Yes, together with Nigeria, especially the Nigeria Delta. They are at present the most dangerous spots.
And how common are hijackings and kidnappings there?
Hijackings have become, in 2005, they kind of exploded in Somali waters. And in the first half of 2006, during the second half of 2006, the Islamic courts took control of Somalia, and especially also the coastline. And this meant that the pirates couldn't operate. So for the second half of 2006, there were nearly no incidents with hijackings or piracy attacks. Then the transitional federal government in Somalia, together with the Ethiopian army, kicked out the Islamic courts. And when the Ethiopian army withdrew from the coastal areas where the pirates operate from, they came back and started their operations again. So that was in late January, and from March they have been have been going forward.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed for telling us all about that. That was Hans Tino Hansen, who is the managing director of the Danish security company Protocol, and it advises shipping firms about piracy and negotiations. You're listening to Europe Today on the BBC World Service. It's time now to hear the second choice of our guest editor, Tuomas Hendrik Ilves, the president of Estonia. This day, August the 23rd, back in 1939, was the date stamped on the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, the supposedly non-aggressive pact between the German Third Reich and the Soviet Union. It included a secret protocol in which Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland and Romania were divided into spheres of interest. They were all subsequently invaded, occupied or forced to cede part of their territory to either the Soviet Union, Germany or indeed both. Mr. President, why have you chosen this issue today?
Well, I think that given the day that I was going to be on the program, it was quite appropriate to look at one of the defining decisions of the 20th century, under which people have almost 75 million people have suffered since 1939. It was basically a decision between two totalitarian regimes to carve up the world between them, and they did so. And to this day, we are suffering the consequences.
Well, what is the relevance and the impact today, 2007?
Well, for one, if you actually look at how many people were killed between 1940 or 1939 and 1945 as a result of this decision, and at least in the communist-occupied period, the mass deportations that continued following World War II, that you have a lot of historical issues to deal with. Moreover, one of the reasons why it remains important is that, unfortunately, the Russian government actually refuses to admit its responsibility for it, while claiming to be the successor state to the Soviet Union. For all intents and purposes, it continues to justify the action as a self-defensive move, which is clearly absurd, nor does it accept any responsibility for the hundreds of thousands of people that were murdered as a consequence of this act.
And in your view, that refusal to do that means what for Estonia and the other Baltic countries?
Well, also Poland and Romania. I think it's a larger issue of refusal to deal with one's past. I mean, Germany certainly deals with its past and accepts responsibility for the crimes against humanity committed against millions of people, whereas, unfortunately, other regimes steadfastly refuse to do so.
Okay, Mr. President, you're staying with us, of course, and you're going to hear what the views of the people in your own country and others are on this issue, because we've been finding out how much of an impact this Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact still has on people's lives in the Baltic countries today. We've been canvassing opinions on the streets of Tallinn. What do they know, first of all, about the agreement?
It wasn't very good for Estonians, this pact, I know. Historically, it's important, but I don't know that we are affected very much.
Excuse me?
The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
I don't know.
Of course I know it. It's being studied all over again many times in Estonian education system. I think it's very important.
It was pact between Germany and Russia, and with it they divided their interests, considering these countries, nearby Baltic states and Poland and some others.
Does it matter today still?
To me it matters.
Well, that was Tallinn. We've been asking the same question to Latvians on the streets of the capital Riga.
It was in the Second World War, so Molotov was from Russia and Ribbentrop was from Germany, and they made the map where they divided the countries between Russia and Germany, and it was like a secret act. Nobody knew, but Stalin and Hitler, of course, were in charge of that. It's very important, yes, firstly because it's our history, and secondly because I think some parts still are affected of this. Not so much, I think, but some parts are, yeah.
It was a pact between Russians and Germans. They split Europe in two parts, one for Germans, one for Russians, and we were in the Russian side, so it's important because we're a new country and history always repeats, and we must learn from our history to improve our future.
That was the view on the streets of Riga. So what is the attitude to the pact today in Russia? And has its history been revised to shift attention away from what the Soviets did in the Baltic countries and elsewhere? Professor Norman Davies is from Oxford University and the author of Europe, A History. We're also joined from Moscow by Russian historian Sergei Kudryashov. You're both very welcome indeed. Professor Davies, I'll start with you. Is it your view that Soviet crimes were relegated to Nazi ones?
It depends where. In the Soviet Union, there was only one form of war crime, and that was fascist crimes. All crimes committed by the Soviet Union were denied. But oddly enough, the same is true in our country, in the United Kingdom, that war crimes have been defined as crimes committed by Germany or on German-occupied territory. This means that a whole raft of terrible mass crimes are denied by our own authorities. So yes, this is an extremely important subject which is of interest not only to the Baltic states and the whole of Eastern Europe, but also I think to the whole of the world, because our views of the origins of the contemporary world go back to World War II, and we have a very strange view of World War II.
Okay, well, let's hear from Sergei Kudryashov, joining us this evening from Moscow. What do you make of that?
Good evening. Well, I think in modern Russia they do not pay a lot of attention to this particular act. And if you look at programs of TV and radio just today, I mean, you will not notice that they pay particular attention to this historic event. And I think it's visible that Russian authorities and Russian government doesn't want to remind about it. So they want it to be just an act of history. That's it.
And that's it. I mean, there's no other official policy. There's no recognition, is there, of what took place all those years before?
Well, at the moment, not. When Putin was asked about it several times ago, he just said that the Soviet authorities and at the beginning of the 90s, Russian authorities already said a lot of stories, and he didn't want and doesn't want to repeat them.
Professor Davies, do you believe that there is a distorted view of the pact in Russia?
My view would certainly be that, but I'm more interested in the perception of the pact and of the Second World War in the world at large. In Britain and America, there's an overwhelming view that the sole evil power of the Second World War was the Third Reich of Nazi Germany. The idea that our later ally from 1941, the Soviet Union, was in the hands of a mass murdering tyrant who was capable of many things as Hitler was, is almost completely absent. We simply do not have the emotional awareness, even if we have the intellectual awareness, of the significance of this pact and of the collaboration between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany between 1939 and 1941, when the overwhelming view is that the Soviet Union was somehow neutral, even though Soviet forces invaded five countries, annexed three, took over parts of Romania and Poland, and indeed held a joint victory parade with the Wehrmacht in Brest-Litovsk.
Why do you think that attitude in the West exists?
I think because if British and American people were to admit the atrocities committed, as it were, on our side of the war in the fight against the Third Reich, committed largely by Soviet forces, then the whole moral basis of the good war, of the fight against evil in the Third Reich, would be destroyed. So we, like many people in Russia, prefer simply not to remember it.
Sergei Kudryashov, you've talked about how the Russian government, how the Kremlin views the pact. What about ordinary Russians? Do they have a distorted view, or do they accept the reality?
Well, I must say that Russian society is split at the moment, and you could find any views like in any other country. So if you watch on internet sites, you could find, I mean, any reaction. Unfortunately, the Russian military are still obsessed with the idea of hero of Comrade Stalin and his impact, a good and bad impact on Russian society. Unfortunately, the Russian military still think that regardless of many bad things of Comrade Stalin, he did a lot of good things for the country. As a result, they are very reluctant to admit that he committed criminal acts, especially in foreign politics. As far as ordinary people are concerned, much depends on what they are taught at schools. And at schools, it's also a little bit controversial, because in Russian textbook, you will read that certainly it was an immoral pact, and something went terribly wrong. But at the same time, old Soviet version or Stalinist version is still there, that somehow Soviet Union bought 2 years of rest, of preparation for the war against Germany, and so on.
Professor Davies, just finally back to you. How strongly do you think this pact and its result affects the view of the world in the Baltics and Poland and Romania?
Well, it is an event of prime importance for the countries which lost their independence, lost their existence for several years, and followed by decades of captivity in a totalitarian regime. So obviously for them, this is of prime importance. But it's of great importance for us as well. Unless you understand why it was atrociously wrong for this pact to have been put into effect and for Europe to have been divided into spheres of influence, if you can't understand that, then I don't think you can understand either the origins of the Second World War or indeed the moral force of what actually happened.
Okay, well, thank you both very much indeed for taking part in our discussion this evening. Professor Norman Davies from Oxford University and Russian historian Sergei Kudryashov joining us this evening from Moscow. Let's return to our guest editor, whose choice this was, President Tomas Hendrik Ilves from Estonia. Mr. President, you've heard what those two gentlemen had to say there. Is it still a traumatic event in Estonia, talking about this?
No, it's not at all a traumatic experience to talk about it. It was as late as 20 years ago when people were put in jail for talking about the secret protocols. In fact, just today, 20 years ago, was the first public demonstration in the Soviet Union anywhere in the Soviet territory of the Soviet Union, in which the protest was against the secret protocols, demanding that they be published. Today it's not traumatic. In fact, in many ways, today is almost celebratory in that today marks the beginning of the movement towards independence. But the after effects of the war are so strong. I mean, you have to understand that if 60% of the population of the country has had an immediate relative shot, exiled, deported, that the war weighs very heavily on people's consciousness. And so the etiology of the war is something which is extremely important. Moreover, I think, and with this I'll sort of try to conclude, is that really the absolute moral or immoral equivalence of Nazism and communism, which Professor Davies referred to in terms of Western attitudes, is something that's very clear here. I mean, for us, a swastika is a hammer and sickle. Nazism is communism. We don't distinguish between the two. They were both murderous, awful regimes. And this is something which we find sometimes odd in the West, in that it's kind of that it's morally better to be killed by a communist than by a Nazi. For people in our countries, it's all the same.
Mr. President, we'll talk to you again in a couple of minutes' time. The Russians may no longer have troops in Eastern Europe, but these days they dominate by other means, principally as suppliers of oil, gas and nuclear energy. In an effort to counteract that dominance, countries in the region are looking for alternative resources. However, in the case of the Czech Republic at least, all pipelines lead back to Moscow, as our correspondent Nick Thorpe reports.
The sound of sour, heavy-sulfured crude oil gushing through the pipes at the Százhalombatta refinery just south of the Hungarian capital, Budapest. Almost all of it comes from Russia. There's even a marker stone here in the refinery where the pipe comes in. Druzhba, the friendship pipeline.
I think what we see happening is that Russia is trying to become an energy-based empire.
Eric Best edits an influential daily newsletter in Prague.
Energy experts say we have about 70 years of oil left, and I think it's conceivable that Russia could be planning for the next 70 years to become an energy power and to use its resources to affect political and economic changes that we need to be prepared for.
And that seems to be the crux of the matter. Russians with a bigger timescale. European politicians unable to think beyond four yearly elections. While Hungary, Slovakia and Poland get up to 100% of their gas from Russia, the Czechs were rather proud of their alternative, a pipeline from Norway. But earlier this summer, a government study leaked on the internet drew a disturbing conclusion. Eric Best again.
In fact, the Russians, under swap agreements with Norway, are supplying the gas that would be going through that pipeline, increasing the Czech dependence on Russia to 97% or 99%. This, understandably, is not something that people talk about.
Another side to Eastern Europe's energy dependence on Russia is nuclear. This is the sound of water beneath one of the huge cooling towers at the Dukovany nuclear power station in the Czech Republic. The nuclear fuel and much of the technology comes from Russia. And though spent fuel is no longer sent back, those shipments could restart in the future. The real prize for the Russians would be to gain control of the big energy companies of Eastern Europe, like ČEZ in the Czech Republic, MOL in Hungary, PKN Orlen in Poland. Yefim Fishtein is head of the Russian service of Radio Free Europe.
They delivered nuclear fuel for the Czech nuclear power plants, but at the same time they offered their territory for processing of the nuclear waste, and that can be the way how to take control over the ČEZ energy company. So it's just one of the examples how they work.
Also in Prague, political commentator Jiří Pehej says much depends on who comes after President Putin.
It is very difficult for a small country like the Czech Republic to understand its intentions. Moreover, Russia is at this point an unpredictable country. We don't know who will come after Putin. Maybe someone who would like to renew Russia's great imperial designs.
Back at the Százhalombatta refinery in Hungary, the Hungarians, like all the other East Europeans, are keen to keep doing business with the Russians today. But in strategically important industries, they would prefer not to be owned by them. While Russian businessmen make no secret of their desire to buy what they can. The paradox is that the country which once ordered the nationalisation of industry in Eastern Europe now stands most to gain from its privatisation.
That was Nick Thorpe reporting there from the Czech Republic. Let's have a final chat now this evening with our guest editor, the President of Estonia, Tomas Hendrik Ilves. Mr. President, just on that report, energy supplies, is it a worry for you as well in Estonia?
Well, I think it's a worry not only in Estonia and not only in Eastern Europe, but in fact it is a worry in all of Europe. And I mean, if you do read the homepage of the foreign ministry of the Russian, homepage of the foreign ministry, you'll see that in fact they explicitly say that energy is a tool of foreign policy. So I think it's a concern for many of us all over the region, and it is a concern for the European Union as well, because the means by which this is expanding actually violates most of the rules of competition in the European Union, and not much has been done about that.
We've been talking, of course, about the Hitler-Stalin Pact and the refusal, as you see it, of Russia to recognise their crimes, the Soviet crimes. What will it take, do you think, to make peace with Russia?
Well, I think that's up to Russia. I mean, if you have a chip on your shoulder and can't really admit what you've done in the past. For me and for most Estonians, I'd say East Europeans, the contrast is always with Germany. Germany, which who's had a regime that committed unspeakable crimes, we highly respect because it doesn't threaten its neighbors, it admits responsibility, and we've moved on. The problem is if you build up your national consciousness by denial of what has been done to other countries, then you will be stuck with that sort of cancer until you do admit what has been done in the past.
And what about your own country and others like Georgia, for example? Some might accuse you of deliberately riling Russia. Is that a fair accusation?
It's very hard to really say that. I mean, a country of 1.4 million against 140 million. And riling consists of denying Soviet versions of history. If you talk about unspeakable Soviet crimes against humanity, you're being disrespectful of the Soviet their history of Russia. It's just bizarre. I mean, we don't understand it here. We do wish the Russians would own up to what they've done to millions of people.
Okay, well, we're nearly finished this evening's program, Mr. President. Did you enjoy guest editing the program?
Well, I haven't been an editor on the radio for about, 15 years, but I used to do this every day.
So you're an old hand at it. Do you miss it?
Well, it's fun. I like the attention of can you get the program filled? Do you have too much? Do you have too little?
Exactly. It's a daily battle, especially in August.
Yes.
Mr. President, it's been lovely having you on the program this evening. Thank you very much indeed for being our guest editor, President Tomas Hendrik Ilves, President of Estonia. We'll be back with a regular edition of Europe Today tomorrow. Till then, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.